Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Crimes, Killers, Cults.
And beer.
And beer.
Or in my case, rum and coke in my blue sippy cup.
Powder blue sippy cup.
Yes, I forgot the powder. My bad.
Right. You can't leave out the powder blue sippy cup. Anyway, that's just two crazy Florida men drinking beer or rum out of a powder blue sippy cup and talking about true crime. Because, I mean, really, it's because that's what this podcast is. And if you don't like it, go listen to true crime all the time.
No, just no, don't, keep listening don't, to us. Don't, I don't care if don't you don't like it or not. Just listen to us. Just keep listening. We'll eventually do something you like.
We got a special episode for you tonight. We're basically going to be hijacked tonight. And in a good way. But before we bring our guest in, I just got a note, Todd. We already said that you're drinking rum and coke out of a powdered blue sippy cup. I'm drinking a Bud Light, which the label matches my shirt. Look at that. It like disappears when I put it on my shirt.
I like it.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So, yeah, we have a special episode or a special guest host tonight who's basically going to be taking the lead. Her name is Nora Ashley, and she is a survivor who has become an activist against the troubled teen industry, which, you know, so it's just like when we started talking about doing this episode, I'm like, you know what? You just take the lead and run with it because you know a hell of a lot more about it than I do. So I got a night off. I get to be like Todd, just sit there and go, hey, yeah, that's fucked up. Damn.
Oh, come on, dude. I don't sound like that.
No.
Thank God. I'd have to quit if I really sounded like that.
But work on that monotone. Work on that monotone, though.
Oh, come on. She loves the monotone. It's fine.
So, anyway,
stop
we're going to
play with my mic, man, you know?
Oh, there's that. So
we're going to
bring
her in. That's what she said.
Yeah, that's what she said.
So we're going to bring her in right now, Miss Nora Ashley, and she's going to be launching a podcast here very shortly, and we're just going to, you know, like basically send her on her way and, you know, like christen her podcast, basically. And after I finish this Bud Light, I'll break it on my desk to christen it properly. No, I won't do that. Anyway, hey, Nora, how are you?
I'm good. Hi, Bill. Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being
thanks
here.
For coming on. So,
appreciate it.
So right now, we're just going to turn it over to you. Let her rip, Tater Chip.
Well, first of all, introduce myself. I am, my name's Nora. I am a survivor of the troubled teen industry. I attended two wilderness programs and a therapeutic boarding school from 2003 to 2005 in Utah and Montana. I kind of have a question. I would kind of like Todd to kind of guide this since you don't really know a lot about this. I want to know, you know, what do you want to know?
I'm not sure that that's a good idea.
Yeah, I should don't put me in charge. So the episodes where I've been in charge, I haven't been well. But no, if just
how about
tell,
like
tell your
where
story
should I
like
where should I start? Do you want me to like tell about the industry, or do you want to just me to just jump into my own experience?
Give us a brief about the industry. You know, just let people know what it is, because I mean, I know what it is through listening to podcasts and everything. Mm-hmm. And before we get started, and then I have a question, would Teen Challenge be one of these?
Yep. Okay. Teen Challenge. You know, I'm going to start at the very freaking beginning.
Start with like an overview of what TTI is for those of our listeners who might not know. And then we want to hear your story, and then you kind of wrap it up with what you're doing now, leading the charge against these chuckleheads. So
sounds like a plan. So yeah, the troubled teen industry is a collection of controversial programs that are designed to help troubled teenagers. We don't like that term. We haven't come up with anything better. But we don't like that troubled term because that is a label that sticks with survivors your entire life. That second that you get sent away and you get into your first program and you've been labeled troubled, that will stick with you for the rest of your life. And so it's a collection of programs that they're residential programs usually, and they include wilderness programs, therapeutic boarding schools, residential treatment centers, things like that. But then like the pipeline into it is educational consultants, that recommend these programs. They get money from them. They get kickbacks from the programs themselves. Plus the parents pay them
a lot of money.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. A lot of money for my three programs over the course of 20 months. My parents paid, somewhere around $960,000.
Holy crap.
Huge astronomical amounts of money. Wow. And so, and then usually the way the kids physically get there is, there are companies called juvenile transport companies that will come and pick kids up in the middle of the night, drag them out of bed, throw them in a car in handcuffs, which is like my case, put you on a plane and go dump you at whatever program your parents are paying for now.
So,
wow.
And there have been like deaths and abuse and everything. And it's not even allegations. It's been proven that it's happened.
The deaths are my niche, kind of like my expertise in this. There have been 311, now 311 as of July 18th, which is the most recent one. 311 industry deaths that have been confirmed and have documentation to back them up. There are also a number that have gone unreported.
I'm sure.
So,
like they're buried out in the desert somewhere.
Yeah. Exactly. And there are actually, there's a couple stories of cases where kids ran from programs and they've never been found. Which doesn't surprise me one bit.
No.
With how isolated a lot of these places are. It's very, very easy. If you run, there's nowhere to go. You're going to get picked up and taken right back, or you're going to get lost and die out there.
Because it's out in the wilderness, out in the middle of freaking nowhere. And you're blindfolded when you're taking that. So you have no bearing of where you are. Right.
Exactly. Ugh, most kids go from the educational consultants really like to push wilderness programs because that way they get paid by the parents for suggesting the wilderness program plus the long-term residential program, plus the wilderness programs pay them. And then the long-term residential program pays them as well. So the more programs that they can push on a kid, the more money they're making.
Right.
And here's your cult connection. Have you guys ever heard of the Church of Synanon?
Yes.
Okay. The Church of Synanon is the beginning of this. That's kind of so there's well, two teen, kind of parallel.
Teen Challenge existed in the late 80s.
Correct. Let me pull up my numbers so I can tell you I know that I'm being accurate when I am giving your facts. Synanon was started in 1958 as a drug rehab center for adults that ultimately ended up evolving into the Church of Synanon. Now, three former residents of Synanon went on to found the beginning of what is the TTI. Daytop Village, which was another drug rehab for adults, which was started in 1963. 1967, there was CEDU, C-E-D-U. That was founded by another former resident of Synanon. That is programs for children. And then in 1970, another former resident of Synanon founded the SEED, which was the drug rehab for youth. And then each of those keep going. So Daytop Village, a former resident named Joe, I can't remember his last name right now, started the Elan School in 1970. CEDU purchased a long-standing residential parent company of residential programs called the Brown Schools, and then a former resident, parents of a former resident of the Seed, founded Straight Inc. Have you heard of that program?
I think so.
I haven't.
That Straight Inc. was really the beginning of the modern TTI. That started in 1976. From there, Kid Centers of America was founded, and I believe Teen Challenge falls under them. But as you can tell, like, this is all very interconnected.
I'll get into what I know about Teen Challenge at some point.
Okay. You know. Okay. And what I know, what my expertise is primarily along the non-religious side of things. However, there is a secondary parallel timeline of religious programs. The precursors to the TTI programs for both were started in 1940. And then there was a man named Lester Roloff, who started a company called Roloff Evangelical Enterprises. And that was the beginning of all of the religious programs. However, both the religious and non-religious programs have had a parallel timeline. So when one of them opened one program one year, the other would open a program the next year. When Roloff's program started falling under a larger, where instead of each program is owned separately by a single owner, one person will own multiple programs. And when that shift happened, the same shift happened in both the religious and non-religious sides. Companies started taking over. Companies like CDU, and now one of the biggest is NATSAP, National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. That was actually
my mind went somewhere else when you said NATSAP.
SAP, NATSAP.
SAP. I thought you said FAP.
The owner and director of my boarding school in Montana, it was called Mission Mountain School. And he was NATSAP's founding treasurer. That school was shut down in 2008 after a congressional hearing where a former student as well as a former therapist both testified in front of Congress about the abuses that happened in these programs. And that's how my program personally was shut down. My wilderness program was open for 24 years. They actually just shut down June 15th voluntarily because of an insurance issue, is what my understanding is.
And that was obviously just the sugar-coated version of what they're, you know.
So the religious side, the non-religious side, they're very parallel to each other. But the other interesting thing about that is that both of those also, because as you know, Synanon began as a drug rehab center. Both the religious and non-religious sides have a parallel timeline to the war on drugs.
Are you saying that this was somehow connected to the Ronald Reagan's Just Say No program?
That is exactly what this is. This is the Yes Don't or Just Say No program.
Yes. Wow. I got that.
I hit that one out of the park.
Yes.
Yeah, I caught that one too, which is unusual for me.
So
I'm not used to being the number two guy. So so forgive me if I,
Bill's used to knowing all the answers ahead of time.
Well, this is good because we got someone who doesn't know very much. We got someone who knows enough to ask questions, and then I can answer everything. In 1981 was when Ronald Reagan announced that the war on drugs was now full on warfare against drug use in America. And that's really when it started focusing on criminal punishment for drug offenses. Both Reagan and his wife, as well as Princess Diana, backed Straight Inc., which was started by it goes Synanon, and then a former resident started the Seed. parents of a resident of the Seed started Straight Ink. And that's where the Reagans come in.
Can I enter? Do you remember DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education?
I'm a 90s kid. Kids off drugs. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, there was a band. I'm not going to go too much into detail, but there was a punk band, a comedy punk band where we're from back in the 90s. And they did made bumper stickers with the same font as DARE. And it says D mm-hmm. period, A period, R period, E period. And then at the underneath it, it says drugs are really expensive.
That's funny.
And oddly enough, the singer for the band he's talking about was the last person that hijacked our podcast.
No, that was Scurvy. That wasn't dead serious. That wasn't dead.
I thought that was dead serious. All right, never mind.
No, it was Scurvy. I'm wrong.
It wasn't Steel Panther, was it?
No, I loved them.
I love Steel Panther.
I saw them at concert. They're great.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on Lonely Island. Or Rucka Rucka Ali. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. Don't look him up.
Okay.
Okay. I learned my
vulgar and offensive.
When somebody tells me not to look something up, I take their word. I learned my lesson after somebody told me not to look up Two Girls One Cup.
Jesus.
Okay. Rucka Rucka Ali is the weird owl that tries to make everything he says as offensive as possible.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. Okay.
I enjoy it.
See, I'm still mentally 12 years old. So when you tell me not to do something, it's the very first thing I'm going to do.
Mentally, I'm about a 12 year old boy. So.
Anyway. Bring on the wiener jokes.
Yeah.
I think we've already had a couple tonight.
Indeed.
DP anyone? So while Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan, Princess Diana, were backing Straight Ink on the non-religious side of things, we had George H.W. Bush backing the religious side of things. And
that's an oxymoron if you ask me.
The political ties are so intertwined in this. I mean, it comes all the way to modern times. There is Mitt Romney owns Bain Capital, which owns Aspen Education Group, which is the largest umbrella company of TTI programs in Utah. And then there is Ted Cruz, who sent his daughter away 2 years ago to a program.
Really?
Ted Cruz? Damn it. Now I have to not like him.
Now, there are also a number of other celebrities who've sent their kids away. Barbara Walters, Tom Hanks, Chet Hanks is fucked up because of this.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you've seen any interviews with him or anything, but this stuff ravaged him.
Oh, wow.
I knew he had issues, but I didn't know it was because of this.
Yep, that's where it comes from. And then there's Kate from John and Kate Plus Eight. She managed to send one of their kids away. And John had to fight in court to get him out. I actually know a woman who is fighting that same battle right now. Her son is in his third or fourth program. And she cannot, there's a loophole in, a divorce agreement where her ex was able to put her son into a program, but she can't get him out without her ex-husband's signature. So that's their battle. But back to the celebrities who sent their kids away. Clint Eastwood, Rosie O'Donnell, Marie Osmond, Mark Hughes, the founder of Herbalife, Casey Kasem, Farrah Fawcett, Michael Douglas, Cher. It just goes on and on and on and on. And while Paris Jackson wasn't sent by her celebrity parents, she was also part of this. So was Drew Barrymore, Kat Von D, Paris Hilton. This is something that impacts people all everywhere, from kids in the foster care system who get sent to these places, all the way up to, the Hiltons and are many of the politicians who run our country.
Bam. I mean, that's a lot that I knew about Paris Hilton. I knew about Paris Hilton's kind of become an activist against her, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In a very selective way, her approach and her agenda is very tailored, very deliberate and intentional. And she, like I said, she has an agenda and a purpose. Kind of the way I look at the all survivors is we all have an angle that we want to help from. And hers right. has been legislation primarily. And then, you know, there's people all over the survivor community who are kind of attacking this from all different angles at once. But Paris's focus has been legislation primarily. Right now she's working on SICA, S-I-C-A-A. I can't remember what the S and I are, but it's against Child Abuse Act. It's a it's a congressional piece of legislation that is supposed to be putting protections in place and giving rights to kids in these programs.
No, I got a question. Is Paris Hilton, because I haven't really heard anything from her in years other than her involvement with being an activist against these things. Is that kind of like her life's goal? She's going to the top to bring, you know, to bring legislation against this type of stuff? Because I mean, I can't remember the last time I heard of a Paris Hilton, you know, movie or anything like that.
Yeah, this is kind of her focus now. I mean, she's got her family, she has kind of tailored her life around her activism is based in legislation and lawmaking and working with the politicians right. who are willing to work with survivors to change the laws to actually give children in these places rights and protections. Because as much as many survivors try to scream that we need complete abolishment of the industry. That's just not realistic. Parents are always going to be looking for residential programs for their troubled kids. And what we need is complete industry reform.
Yeah.
We need parents safe places that are going to help their kids as an alternative to what's going on now. And that's how we're going to essentially bring down the industry, we need to turn it into and make it evolve into something that is the complete opposite of what it is now.
So,
that's a big goal. I mean,
yeah, well,
I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying that's a pretty big
hill to climb.
Yes, yeah. That's where I was just going.
And legislation like Paris is focusing on is only a tiny part of it.
Well, yeah.
So, it's going to take a multifaceted, multi-angle approach by, you know, as many survivors who are willing to work on this as possible.
When I found out that Paris Hilton, because I used to think of Paris Hilton as just a dumb, rich, blonde brat, you know, and then when I heard about this and that she was like basically, you know, like leading one of the fronts against the assault on them, you know, and I was just like, holy crap. I think I like this girl now, yeah. You know, and
she's pretty badass.
Yeah. I mean, it's just
what she did for the survivor community. And there are a lot of survivors who try to minimize this and negate it and say, oh, well, you know, she's only doing it for herself. But one thing that you cannot fucking ignore is the fact that nobody knew about this until she said something and she made it okay.
She was
for people
the one
to listen to the rest of us.
I mean, if it hadn't been for her, you know, I mean, you know,
happened to be her. I mean, it could have been Chet Hanks. It could have been Drew Barrymore. It could have been Paris Jackson. It could have been anybody, but it needed to be somebody who had a big public platform.
It could have just been some knucklehead that started a podcast.
Yeah.
And I've been accused, you know, because it's like, you know, Faith Assembly and Hobart Freeman and all that stuff. I mean, there are still people out there. I mean, that cult is still in existence and you know, a smaller form. But there are people that still buy that doctrine, hook, line, and sinker and everything. And I've been contacted. I'm not going to read any of this stuff. I haven't even told Todd about any of this shit. But I have been contacted by people that still worship at the altar of Hobart Freeman, and it's just, oh, you're just in it for the money. Well, dude, if it was just in it for the money, it would be, you know, it's just like, okay, what does Richard Ramirez have to do with Faith Assembly?
Where's the money?
Yeah, where's the fucking money? I started this podcast to be a true crime podcast, and we just happened to do two episodes on the cult that I was, and since cult is in our name,
it is.
I mean, yep. It's just, you know, so we did two episodes on the cult that I was raised in, and honestly, and this is kind of what's going to happen with you, you know, as your podcast, once you launch it, as it gains traction and whatnot, people, you know, survivors are going to start reaching out to you because that's what's happened to me. And, you know, it's just like, I've talked with probably close to 100 different survivors of Faith Assembly.
I have a Discord server of survivors from the TTI that currently has 150 members in it. I actually have a survivor I'm mentoring right now, at my house. They're eating dinner with my family right now.
Nice.
His mom sent him to his first program when he was 5 years old. He'd spend from 5 to 10, he spent like a few months in a program, and then he'd go home for a few months, and then she'd send him to another program for a few months. But at age 10, she sent him to a program and she never allowed him to come home. When he finished a program or was kicked out or graduated, he didn't get to come home. She sent him straight to another program. And he just got out of his last program in February.
There is something.
Wow.
This is my opinion based on what you just said. There is something compared to, you know, there's something like this with parents that just want to keep shipping their kids off to, it's like, okay, I'm done with this program. Oh, he's still fucked up, so let's just send him to another one and everything. There's a lot that's kind of has some similarity to Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Because, yes. You know, it's just like, oh, yeah. It's never enough. It's never enough. It's never enough. And all that stuff.
Well, and where that comes from is the deceptive marketing that is rampant in the industry. The way I like to put it is there is no better manipulator on earth than the people who are able to convince parents to sell their children into this and pay for the abuse that happens.
Yeah.
And they don't do it by it's deception. It is nothing but deception and manipulation. Just like any cult leader.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
And
they can convince people, they can convince these parents to sell their kids because it is the best thing for their kids. And half the time, they don't try to hide any of it.
Yeah.
Because parents are so desperate. Most parents are just desperate to see their kids better and succeed. And like in my mom's case, she just wanted to see me feel better. She didn't want to see me hurting anymore. My dad, on the other hand, is the other kind of parent that you see a lot in this, is the narcissistic type who is so concerned about their public image that they refuse to have their child as part of their family because their child is an embarrassment to them.
Yep.
They don't want anybody to find out about how their kid's been acting because then it's going to make them look bad. And that's another like core piece of how these programs run is, I mean, this stuff has been around since the 1940s or earlier.
Jeez.
And I mean, when did you guys hear about this? A couple of years ago when Paris is now, right?
No, I've known about it since the late 80s. Yeah. But
That is because of the fact that you have that cult background.
Right.
Because you were a little bit more privy to the existence of these places. Because a lot of cults will send their kids to these places. I know a number of people who got sent to the TTI out of Scientology. And it just
seems like, random thought. If a cult member is going, like somebody from the FLDS, or Scientology or whatever, is going to send their kids off to like one of these troubled teen industry farms or torture chain or gulags or whatever.
I like to compare it to POW camps.
Yeah. Gulag.
Gulag. That was a good word, Bill. That was a good one.
But it isn't that basically an admission of failure of the doctrine of the cult?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, logically, yeah. Yeah, it is.
It's like, okay.
But well, the reason our that magical, they feel comfortable.
Our magical
the reason system. They feel comfortable sending kids to these places is that they use the same brainwashing tactics as the cults do. They are confident that when they send their kids to these programs, they're not going to come out of them not believing in Scientology. If anything, they're going to believe in it more.
Okay, I get that.
Yeah.
But and of course, at the same time, you're not going to have somebody like from, say, the FLDS, you know, like under Warren Jeffs or whatever. Warren Jeffs, nobody in Warren Jeffs sect of the FLDS is going to send their kids off to that because there's too much dirt.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and as you know, some cults prefer to deal with any issues that might arise among their members in house. They'll deal with it themselves. And honestly, the way that they do that, is exactly using the exact same tactics as the TTI does. It's just a matter of who's doing it.
Yeah. So you might have a kid like in say Scientology or whatever that is okay. At the FLDS isn't a good example, but maybe Scientology or even fucking Faith Assembly, or you know any number of the like the religious offshoot, you know, the religious sects or whatever, and so it's just like, okay, you might have a kid that's kind of an embarrassment. That's not like latching on to the principles of the cult. So then it's like, okay, we'll just send him out into the wilderness, you know, where he can just be brainwashed and everything. Maybe the people that run it have got a little playbook. It's like, okay, Scientology. All right. We treat them this way. Okay. Right. Faith Assembly. Okay. We treat them this way and everything. And they just literally beat the shit out. Yeah. Because like Faith Assembly, Scientology and stuff like that, you're not isolated. You are isolated. You're isolated from your friends and family, but you're not isolated to the point to where you can't even see a car drive by or a building or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. See a car drive. Oh my God. So I'll, that's a good segue. I'll get into my own experience. I went to a wilderness program first. I was 16 years old. I got woken up at 4:17 in the morning, December 22nd.
How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
36. I have been out of my program 18 years ago as of June, and I was sent away 20 years ago this December.
God damn.
And so I was 16. I was woken up at 4:17 in the morning, December 22nd, 2003, by two strangers in my room, who dragged me out of bed, gave me a strip search, and then told me to get dressed, put me in handcuffs, dragged me out of my house, put me in an SUV, took me to the airport, put me on a plane, flew me to Utah. It was not until I was on that plane and they made the announcement that we would be going to Utah that I had any clue as to what was going on.
Where were you living at the time?
Marin County, California, just north of San Francisco.
Oh, okay. Okay.
David Carpenter's territory.
David Carpenter.
Yep. Some of the Zodiac. There's some interesting ones in there that I could get into, but that's an interesting area. It is very affluent. The majority of parents have very, very high paying jobs.
That makes sense. It's considering it cost your parents like close to $1 million.
Yep.
That's just,
exactly. Like I said before, you know, not just anybody can send their kids to these places. The majority of my friends actually in that area were also adopted like I was, which brings a whole nother facet into all of this.
Jeez,
because
I'm sure they used that against you.
Yeah. Actually, the reason I got sent away was because being adopted, when you enter adolescence and you are in that phase of self-discovery and trying to find yourself in the world, most people who were raised by their biological families have a foundation to base that on. There are people in their family who they can look at and say, okay, I want to succeed like this person, but I want to use some of the approaches that this person used. And there's familiar traits and behaviors that you can see in those people. Well, adoptees enter that stage of trying to find yourself in the world with nothing. We have nothing to base our identities off of. We have nothing to base our goals on. And that's why a lot of us struggle. Because and our parents don't understand it, because, you know, it really takes and it's, you know, it's going to be the same with people who've been in a cult or people who've been in the TTI. Nobody's ever going to really understand it unless they've been there.
All right.
Yeah. And in the TTI, there's a good, I mean, on average, most people, when I asked them how many adoptees were in their program, they said probably somewhere between 70 and 80% of the program was adopted kids.
Damn.
Or foster kids, who are sent from out of state foster care systems, into these programs. But being adopted adds a whole new, like, feature into the trauma of the TTI, because we already have abandonment issues. And for most of us, our parents spent our entire lives trying to reassure us and promise us that they weren't going anywhere and that we weren't going to be abandoned again, and, you know, try to heal that abandonment trauma just to do it again.
When you were taken, were your parents, did you see your parents on your way out?
Nope.
Bam.
The transport companies actually tell parents on their websites, you can look it up, like under their, a lot of them on their homepages will say, we will come to your house, preferably during nighttime hours, where when your child is in bed. And basically they do it for the shock value. If they wake you up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you're going to be drowsy and tired and disoriented, right, and you're not going to have a clue as to what's going on, meaning you're much more likely to be put into the freeze or the fawn stage of response to stress, much more than the fight or flight. Yeah. So you're less likely to run. You're less likely to fight them. You're much more likely to be compliant. Another thing that these places do is they encourage parents to drug their children.
Jesus.
Like NyQuil or something like that?
My parents gave me 3 Ambien the night before.
3? Shit.
My parents are a medical doctor and a registered nurse. And again,
they violated their Hippocratic oath. They violated their Hippocratic oath. Absolutely.
And my parents are not the only medical professionals who drugged their kids. In order to get them to these programs. And that's something that is still going on now. These transport companies encourage parents to sedate their children. Nowadays, so where were your melatonin. They were 2 floors down from where I was in their bedroom. That's another thing that these transport companies actually say straight up blatantly on their website. We would prefer that you not be anywhere where your children could see or hear you, because that might result in combativeness. I screamed bloody murder for my parents. You were being
abducted by like a human trafficker.
I legitimately thought I was being kidnapped.
You were.
That's what survivors call it. We call it legal kidnapping and trafficking, because we are taken out of our beds, our houses, without any idea of what's going on. And we are taken across state lines for the purpose of abuse.
That's the Mann Act. You can't do. I mean, how are they not being charged with this shit?
Because our parents are paying for it, and that is where the stigma of being a troubled kid comes in.
Yeah.
If you're a troubled kid and your parents can't get you under control, that is your fault, and you deserve what's going to come at you. It's the whole theory of tough love.
No, it isn't. Yeah, it's that, but that ain't right. I'm sorry, that's not right.
there's kind of a stigma attached to being a cult survivor as well.
Exactly. You know? And, yeah. Like I was, even like, now,
like my you know, my most recent relationship disaster. I was, you know, she would always just like, you really need to get over that shit and just move on. I was like, all right.
Oh, I've been told the same thing by partners as well.
You're speaking because of your experience in what?
Yeah.
Being a exactly. cunt.
Right.
And
dude, I thought I was going to be the first one to drop the C word.
But well, look who I was talking about.
Oh, I know.
But then, you know, it's like now I'm trying to get back kind of in the dating area and everything, and I can't tell you how many times I've been ghosted ever since I mentioned that I was raised in a cult.
And it's very similar. Like even now, 20 years later, and this is something that that I tell all of my young survivors is, you know, no matter what you try to do, you are never, ever, ever going to fully break that stigma. There will always be people who, the second they hear that you got sent away for being a troubled kid, in their mind, they say, okay, bad kid, got sent away to a program to get fixed. They didn't get fixed there.
No.
Meaning they must be unfixable.
They got made worse.
Bad kid equals bad adult, which kills our credibility instantaneously. And that is why we need people like you guys who are allies, who are willing to get just as angry as we are about this, who can say, this is unacceptable. But we need people.
We haven't even gotten into the gory details yet, and I'm already fucking pissed.
Well,
I'm just sitting over here thinking, God damn, I've led a sheltered life. Holy shit.
Like,
I mean, you guys have been through fucking hell, and I'm just.
There's a reason that my username
really happened to be.
There's a reason that my username on everything is the original Trauma Queen, and that is another thing about the TTI is that kids don't get here because they're happy, well-adjusted, you know, mentally stable kids. These are the vast majority of kids, with the exception of maybe a small handful who actually have legitimate and severe mental health issues. Most of these kids get there because they're acting on trauma responses they have no control over. That is the bad behavior that is happening. It is a maladaptive behavior as a response to trauma.
How much of this is lazy parenting?
That's the core of it.
I was about to say
a big part of it is parents who did not take the time and energy to put into their kids and their relationship with their kids when they were younger. And so they have no foundation for when the kid, when you know, hormones are raging.
Mommy, will you take me to the park? No, I have to go have my cocktails with my peers down at the.
Exactly.
Okay. I always say this because I see it more. I mean, obviously more now, but like, people are having kids just for the tax credit. I mean, they don't raise their kids. They don't know how to raise a kid. They let Xbox and daycare raise their kids.
But well, then Todd, you bring the adoption back into it, and it's the same thing. Parents bought kids just to be able to send them away again.
The people that are doing that though, they don't have the money to be able to send their.
I know, but dude, I've been in the service industry for a long time, and I see it all the time. Like, people will come into a restaurant with their little tiny kids and just let them scream and run around and do whatever because they don't know how to raise a kid. They just, the daycare will take care of it while we work. I mean, I get it. Everybody has to work now, but I mean, I know it's different, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason that toddlers act like that is because they are looking for structure and guidance. And when they're not given that structure and guidance, they don't see their parents as somebody with authority is not authority. A good word,
yeah.
But they don't see their parents as somebody who is worth following and trying to live up to, you know, they don't look at their parents and say, I want to be this person. Another big problem, and I'm a parent of my oldest is 13 now. So I have a teenager myself. Oh,
my youngest is 13.
And he and I have never gotten in a fight. We've never even gotten into a heated disagreement. I've never raised my voice at him. And I plan to keep it that way. A big part of that is, so when kids are toddlers, they need rigid structure and guidance and rules. That's how they learn how to interact with the world. But when you get into adolescence and you're a teenager, you need to be able to explore the world. You need to be able to grow and you need to be able to adapt. And that's how you find your place and your purpose. What a lot of parents do is they keep that same mentality of my kid needs rigid structure. That's the only way to control them.
Yeah.
Because that's how you control a toddler.
Yeah.
But that's what a toddler needs to develop. That's not what a teenager needs to develop.
No, and the biggest core of that
problem.
Mistakes.
Exactly. Yeah. The core of that problem is that while teenagers are growing and learning and adapting and changing,
but that doesn't make them,
their parents kids, are not doing the same thing. Their parents are not adapting and growing and changing their parenting. They're not changing their relationship with their child. Yeah. And a big part of that is that parents do not see children as having, as children's voices as having value. They think, oh, they're too young to know, or, you know,
I agree,
you know, and that's a big part of this, is that that's one way that parents shelter kids, and it's incredibly damaging. Because it keeps kids, like you were saying, from making their own mistakes.
So they learn.
While also knowing for a fact that without question, that regardless of what mistakes they make and regardless of what the external outcomes are for them and consequences, they will always have that safe place that is home.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
A lot of parents do not put time and effort into building their home into that safe place. And that's what causes the rift between teenagers and parents, is they haven't given their child a safe place to go when they make their mistakes. Mm. And so their children are not don't feel safe coming to them and talking to them about their problems. And that's why parents, you know, I think just about everybody has been a teenager and been like, you know, like, my parents don't get me. They don't understand me. They have no idea what I'm going through.
Oh yeah.
Even though, you know, they went through the same struggles themselves, but they also did not have their parents there as that safe place for the most part.
Right. So let's cut it. Okay. So I've heard so many cases, you know, of like things that have actually happened, to kids that were sent to these places. I don't have a list. I mean, but we're not here to talk about that. I mean, you can listen to a bunch of different podcasts where they highlight 20 different situations or whatever. We're talking about you. So, you arrive there at the compound, and what happens next? Kind of take us through that. I mean, how long were you there?
So I went to two different programs. I'll kind of like guide you through all of it. So they put me on a plane. They took me to Utah. My mom's family's from here. My family still lives between Ogden and Provo, all the way down the Salt Lake Valley. And so we flew into Salt Lake, and I was like I knew this was happening because of my behavior, which in my case, it was,
Well, they're probably on that plane ride. They're probably beating that into your head too.
We're not allowed to speak. We're not allowed to talk. We're also not allowed to eat or drink anything. And, basically we stay silent the whole time.
Are they belittling you all through the flight?
They don't say a word.
Oh, that's even worse.
almost the biggest question is, you know, what's happening? Where am I going? And their response is, you'll find out when you get there. And wow. So
that's even worse.
We flew into Salt Lake and started driving down the valley. And I was like, okay, well, maybe they're sending me to live with my grandparents or one of my aunts and uncles because they can't handle me anymore. And I was like, okay, well, that will be okay with me. You know, obviously the way they got me here was fucked up, but then we went past my grandparents' exit and my aunts and my uncles and my cousins' exits and didn't stop. And we ultimately ended up pulling up to this warehouse. The super, like, I remember it being like this long red warehouse building. And they took me in again, another strip search, and I had everything taken from me.
Why would they do another strip search? I mean, did you to make sure you didn't steal anything from the plane while you were in handcuffs?
I guess so.
Because they're perverts, dude. Because they're fucking perverts.
A lot of programs will do strip searches on every time you enter the program and every time you leave the program. Whether that is because you are doing intake or you're graduating or you're going on a home visit or coming home from a home visit or whatever it is. Whenever you enter the property.
I love how child abuse is legalized. That's exactly
what we call it. It's legalized child abuse.
I'm fucking dumbfounded. I cannot, it's not that I can't believe it. I can believe it because the world we live in is fucking just gone crazy.
Well, and again, a big part of that is that, you know, people think that kids don't know any better or they're too young or, you know, that they won't understand. Yeah. And that's actually a big core piece of my trauma is that mentality destroyed me. My first experience with death, I was 6 years old and my parents had a year long opportunity to prepare me for the most important person in my life dying. This is somebody, she was my next door neighbor. She was like my grandma. I spent more time with her and at her house than I spent with my family by far. And they had a year, she had cancer. They had a year to prepare me and explain things and, you know, get me ready for the fact that at some point she was not going to be there anymore. They didn't take any of those opportunities. And then I remember, the day it happened, I went downstairs. My mom wasn't there. I asked my dad where my mom was. He's like, oh, she's over at the neighbor's house. So I obviously went to walk out the door to go over there. He put his arm in front of me, pushed me back and said, you can't go. And that's when I knew something was fucked up. Because nobody ever told me I couldn't go over there. And I was like, why? He's like, well, because she died last night. And that's the last word that anybody said to me about her and her death. Was telling me that she died. I had to learn how to grieve and navigate that. And I still have a block of my entire second grade year. I have an incredible memory. I remember the names of almost every teacher I've ever had, first and last, if not.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of cool.
Bill says that, but he forgets stuff though.
I don't remember second grade. I remember my favorite colored pencil and I remember a story that I wrote. That's it. That's all I remember from that whole year.
Having a memory like that is a blessing as well as a curse.
It is an incredible curse, and that's exactly what I will get into next. So they issued me my gear. Basically, I stood there while they just piled stuff on me. And then they took me and my pile of shit and put me in the back of an SUV, told me to lay down on the back seat, blindfolded me, and drove me from Lehigh, Utah, out into the West Desert, middle of nowhere.
In between the Great Salt Lake and Nevada?
Correct. Yep. There's an Army proving ground out there called Dugway. We were about 40 miles southwest of Dugway. And I have a friend who is actually incredibly into survival and has spent a lot of time in different wilderness settings, in different weather, different circumstances all over the world. He served for a significant amount of time in the military. So he's been overseas in some very inhospitable places. And he, when I told him that that's where we were, he said, holy shit, girl.
Right.
He said, I have not ever been to anywhere that is as desolate and inhospitable as that place.
Well, I mean, you know, for those two people who don't realize, who have never really seen, I mean, the Great Salt Lake, how far west of Salt Lake, not Salt Lake City, but the actual Salt Lake, were you?
Like
in between that and Nevada, because memory serves, it's probably less than an hour from the Great Salt Lake to the Nevada state line. It's like less than an hour.
We'll find out.
Okay. Cool.
So Antelope Island.
What we have a saying here, whenever it's like, we'll find out, we just say, put a knife in that.
Okay. So where we were was, we've got Salt Lake City, and the Great Salt Lake is directly west. Shoots straight down. Shoots straight down about 50 miles, and that's Dugway. And okay. Then we were another about 40 miles southwest of there.
Wow.
There's nothing there.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the interstate that goes south of Salt Lake City.
Of course you are.
I-80?
No, the one that goes south of it. I-80 goes through it. There's another interstate that goes south of it that takes 70. You. Yeah. No, 70. 70 goes east and west. There's another.
The one that goes south from Salt Lake?
Yeah. Yeah.
I-15. I-15.
Right.
I was going to say, if it goes north and south, it has to have a 5 in it.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. Unless it's I-75 in South Florida.
Yeah. Why?
Because it comes into West Florida and then takes a hard left turn east and goes into Miami.
Which is still heading south.
No, it takes, if you look at a
I know what I-75 does, dude. I live in Florida too, motherfucker. I've lived here since 1977. I know Florida. This is my swamp.
I've lived here since 1973. But I did leave for 15 years. So
yeah,
you've actually lived in Florida longer than I have.
I have.
I spent a good part of my childhood, and actually the 5 years before I moved to Utah. I moved back here. Don't ask me why. I tell survivors I live here, and they're like, they look at me like I have three heads and ask me, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Okay. Well, you're familiar with Carpenter. Mm-hmm. Are you also familiar with Joseph Paul Franklin?
I've heard the name. You'd have to remind me of his cases. I'll probably, yeah.
Do not do Farfignugan.
I won't do Farfignugan, I promise.
Farfignugan. What's his name?
But, Joseph Paul Franklin. He was a serial killer, mainly from the South, but he was like super racist. And he actually went, and this is hilarious. We mentioned this in our episode.
I do. I do know him. I know him.
He went to Salt Lake City in the 70s looking for black pimps in Salt Lake City. There were probably three black people in Salt Lake City at that time.
My mom graduated from high school in 1969. And she did not see a black person until she left Utah, went up to Idaho to Ricks College. That is when she met the first black person she'd ever met in her life. In 1970.
Wow.
Outside of Utah.
So JPF, he rolls into Salt Lake City. Where's all the black pimps? I want to kill a black pimp. It's like, there aren't any.
Wait. He's the one that killed the two guys in Liberty Park, right?
Yes, that's him.
Yeah.
No, he managed to find... He managed to find
that the mentoring only, lives right only, next to Liberty Park.
He managed to find the only two black people that lived in Salt Lake City at the time.
Probably in all of Utah.
Yeah.
Who was it?
Because back then the Mormon Church did not accept African Americans into their religion.
There's another.
And even now when they do, there's a very, very, very clear line of how much they're going to accept you. They're not going to fully accept you in. You will always be a little bit of an outsider, like a stepchild. Well, yeah, but interesting, you know, they brought him up.
They also buy into the fact that they think Jesus is white because white makes right, which is
the dumbest fucking
thing is that I've ever heard. Yeah. I mean, dude, I am not religious at all, but I do like reading the Bible, so I know how to like tell somebody like that didn't happen or this is that or your picture of Jesus is not what Jesus looked like. Yeah, where was Jesus he from?
Jesus did not look like Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Or me. Well,
and the Bible can be valuable in the sense that, you know, it gives you an idea of, I mean, essentially it's zeitgeist, what the mentality of the era was.
Yeah.
Yes. I have a funny story just to kind of lighten things up a little bit. And I may have told this once already. Yes, and it's going to be me because... I have to. My daughter, it was her second or third birthday. I'm not sure. I think it was her third birthday. We were at the party and her mom's parents are Mormons, right? Mm-hmm. So they give her a picture of Jesus for her birthday. And it's the typical white version of Jesus that you see everywhere.
Right.
And they go... Yeah. And they go, Amanda, who is that? She looks at it and goes, Daddy.
Oh my God.
Every Mormon in that room turned white as a sheet. And we're like, no. They're like, no, 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 honey. That's Jesus. And she's like, Daddy.
They can get whiter.
Yeah. I mean, after the first time she said it, all the air got sucked out of the room where they all went,
that's hilarious.
That's not why I love my daughter, but that's,
I would hope not.
That's the main reason.
That is a moment in my life with her that I am extremely proud of.
Okay. What I've got is arriving in the field. So, strip search, they give me my gear, they take me out into the middle of the desert, and they dump me out there right when the sun's going down. Yeah. Now, there are rules where you have to complete certain tasks in order to earn things. The first task, when you get there, is to carve a spoon out of a stick.
What?
And the privilege that you earn...
Is you get to eat your cereal without... You know, without you have to eat a cereal with a utensil as opposed to your hand.
No, it's worse than that. You get the privilege of eating.
Of just eating.
Yep. Yep.
With your spoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are not enough bullets in the world to take care of this problem.
It gets worse.
I know it.
I'm just at the beginning.
I know you are.
I might have to tap out here.
So you need a knife, obviously, to carve a spoon. But who's going to give a knife to a bunch of troubled kids who, like in my case, are there because they smoked a little bit of weed and cut themselves once? That's it. That's literally the reasons that my parents sent me away. And again, maladaptive coping mechanisms, trying to deal with the stress of prior traumas.
And hold on, I'm gonna interrupt you there for a second. And you going back to they paid almost $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Was it? And I already know the answer to this, but was it because they cared that much about you, or they just wanted to be like, look at what I'm doing for my daughter? See, we're such good parents.
Actually, and this is actually a very common dynamic for survivors. Is most of the time. Kids will have one parent who is genuinely really just wants to help and is brainwashed and manipulated right along with the kid into believing that this is going to be the fix. And then a lot of times kids have another parent who is that type. Look at what I'm doing to help my kid.
Okay.
So that they can take the credit for it. My wilderness program 20 years ago cost $516 a day.
Jesus Christ.
So obviously you need a knife to carve a spoon. Well, that means that staff needs to, be in a position where they are ready to give you that knife, and supervise you. Well, when I got there, it was dark. It was bedtime. So we went straight to bed. The next day was a hiking day. So we got up, packed up, hiked all day long. And that night when we made camp, and I hadn't eaten again. I was picked up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I hadn't eaten since dinner the night before. So I think I went like 50 something hours without eating. Which actually has played out, and not even just that, but like the whole rest of my story. Like, I spent pretty much my entire time in the TTI being given just enough food to keep me alive. And now that experience shut off my physiological response to hunger. I don't feel hunger anymore. My stomach doesn't hurt. I don't get any physiological responses to blood sugar changes. I literally every time I have a group, most of my friends, when they see me, they ask me when the last time I ate was.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Do they, when parents are, basically in contact with these people, you know, with these groups or whatever, saying, hey, I want to send my kid there, do they go through medical issues that a kid might have, or is it just, hey, come get them? Like, for example,
they go through their psychiatric diagnoses. That's about
it. I'm hypoglycemic. I can't not eat, you know, and if I were to go 50 hours without eating, I'd be dead because my blood sugar would drop.
I was going to say, you'd be out there in the middle of the wilderness on the ground, unconscious, having a seizure.
So they don't even look into that with your, the parents or whatever.
No.
Or what if somebody's diabetic?
They want to know what your behaviors are that got you there. That's about it.
So how many kids died of hypoglycemic shock or diabetic or like insulin, low insulin or whatever?
Surprisingly,
I'm not asking for an exact number, but was it a lot of, I mean, was that something frequent that there would be a lot of deaths or like trips to the emergency room or something because a kid went into insulin shock or blood sugar dropping?
Wait, you said trips to the emergency room?
Probably didn't exist, did they?
Oh, fuck no.
No.
Nope.
Come on, Bill. You know better than that.
And I'll get. Yeah, I will explain the.
So what happens? Okay. The two medical conditions that could like really floor you, like the two most prominent ones are like, you know, diabetes or hypoglycemia. Mm-hmm. So, how many? I mean, were there a lot of? Like how many deaths that happened were attributed just to that?
Bill wants to know how many kids are buried out there in the desert is what he's asking.
And the reason I'm asking is because the cult that I was raised in was a faith healing cult.
Yeah.
My fucking, you know, my hypoglycemia didn't set in until I was like a teenager, like after like 16, 17 years old after I had gotten away from it. So I was able to like start, you know, like.
It's one of those cults that refuse medical care, right?
Yes. Among other things, but, you know, so it's just like, you know, it, and we said this before, that cult had so many satellite branches, like all through the world and everything. Mm-hmm. So if you tally up all of the deaths from Faith Assembly that happened as a result of preventable issues like insulin or hypoglycemia or whatever, Faith Assembly has a higher body count than Jonestown.
So,
yes, they do.
I have talked to a number of staff, and the consensus, the pattern, is that the only reason that every single TTI program does not have a death attributed to it is the program just got fucking lucky. I talked to one former staff for a half an hour. In that time, he was able to outline at least 25 different instances during his 9 months that he worked there where a kid should have died. There should be a death there, and they just got lucky that they didn't. And those go unreported. All those incidents go unreported. So and medical neglect is rampant. Of the three main causes of death in these programs, a third of the deaths that I have found have been because of restraint, followed by suicide, and medical neglect is the third. And so I got out there, and this is another piece of medical neglect, is that my wilderness program, and many of them are like this, they didn't have licenses or staff that were authorized to be able to administer medications. So myself included, if you're on psychiatric medications when you go into your wilderness program, not anymore.
Out the window.
So you're going cold turkey off of everything. Plus, you've just been woken up in the middle of the night, kidnapped, trafficked across state lines, and dumped into the middle of nowhere. And so I got there the night of December 22nd. Now, the next step after you make your spoon is to build a busting kit, which is to make a fire. It consists of 1, 2, 3 pieces of wood, a rock, and some bark. And it's the other name for it is bow drilling. Use a bow to move the spindle, and then that starts the spark. Well, on Christmas Day, it started snowing. Now, our shelters consist of a tarp and a piece of parachute cord. That's it. Our sleeping bags were rated at 20 degrees, and because they reused the same sleeping bags for all the kids, most of ours were filled with holes, really did nothing. And so it started snowing on Christmas Day, and that snow did not stop until New Year's Day. We had 9 feet of snow dumped on us. Jesus, and right. At that point, everything that I needed to build that busting kit was under 9 feet of snow. And so you earned that.
You didn't get to eat because you couldn't make what you needed to make, so you couldn't fucking eat.
I made the spoon. I was allowed to eat. However, the next step is once you basically have to earn fire. And you have to earn.
You would think under cases of fucking 9 feet of snow that they like break out a cigarette lighter.
The staff had them. So
of course.
So you have to earn. You have to make your first fire to earn fire. But the other thing that you earn is entrance into the group. So I spent my time. During this, about 1,000 yards away from the rest of the group, with a staff member coming to check on me twice a day. Other than that, I was under a tarp under 9 feet of snow, essentially having to dig out every 2 or 3 hours, rebuild my entire shelter just to get it, you know, get in, do it all over again.
And never mind the fact that the humidity is high, so you ain't lighting a fire with, you know, a fucking rubbing sticks together.
Right. And everything's wet anyway.
Right.
Everything's soaking wet.
Yeah.
And so once you build your first fire, you earn entrance into the group, which means that you are also allowed to use the group fire. You have to prove to them fire. That you can make fire, but then you're allowed to use the group fire. The other thing that you earn is the privilege of hot and cooked food. During this week. And actually, this blizzard was so big, it is in the top 10 worst blizzards in the state, and it has its own Wikipedia page.
So it's like a Donner Party blizzard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so
if I die, you guys could eat me. I'm telling you right now. I just want that to be known. If I die, if we're ever in something situation like that, and I die, you guys could eat me.
Thanks for that, Todd, because I'm serious. My fucking head was about to explode. I needed that.
Oh, I know. I could tell.
So, it's stuck in this blizzard. The other policy that they had was that when you were in your shelter, they took your shoes to discourage running. That means every time I had to get out of my sleeping bag and get out of my shelter to dig the snow off of my shelter so I could fucking breathe, I was doing it barefoot.
Barefoot.
Every time I went to the bathroom, barefoot, 9 feet of snow.
I need another zinger, Todd, because I'm about to fucking explode again.
I got nothing. Dude,
I mean,
and I knew about this shit. Not this.
At least we didn't have to eat each other.
Yeah.
Not yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. And so we ended up spending 12 days stranded. We had a sat phone, and the headquarters, the owners, people in charge of the program, told us because our senior staff during this was a 23-year-old straight out of college with a psych degree. That's it. That's all we had. And they don't train their staff either. We got fucking lucky. We didn't have dead kids.
Yeah.
Lucky. That's
dude,
all it was.
That's it. I'm broken, dude. This broke me.
And so we ended up stuck out there for 12 days. We ran out of food. We ran out of water. We all had hypothermia. At one point, there was a girl who started having night terrors and pissed herself in the middle of the night. There was no change of clothes. There was no ability to shower. She spent a week and a half in those clothes. Jeez. Frozen to her. Oh, God. Each one of us had our own little separate crisis, I guess. Each one of us faced death in our own way. And at one point they made a group shelter. They put all the tarps together. You know, everyone was kind of huddling for warmth. They had the fire right next to it. Again, I still didn't earn that. So I was 1,000 feet away or 1,000 yards away from everybody else. And then we ran out of wood. And they didn't even have a fire. The last thing that I ate, I think, was on day 6, and it was a handful of dry pasta that I had tried to soften in water, but the water froze before the pasta could soften. That's the last thing that I ate, and then I didn't eat again until we actually left that place.
So since you got there,
mm-hmm.
It had been 50 hours since you had eaten mm-hmm. once you got there. So yeah. You're now like several days into it, and all you've had to eat is dry pasta.
So at this point I was allowed to eat, but, you know, we're stuck in a blizzard. We have to ration. So I was having, you know, like a couple bites of things here and there. We had, vacuum sealed tuna. We had like Ritz crackers, but the majority of our food rations were things that needed to be cooked. I wasn't allowed to cook it, couldn't cook it. So I was eating it dry, raw, whatever. And then we ran out of food. And we ended up spending on day 8, and we spent another 4 or 5 days out there. I heard at one point that there was a local search and rescue company that had offered to do a life flight or air rescue. The company said, oh no, it's fine. They can tough it out. Our senior staff was 22 years old and was begging. They basically told us, they're like, we can't get to you. The roads are snowed in. There's no way to get to you. You're basically
a helicopter.
Fucked. Yeah, but that's going to cut into company profits.
True.
So day 12, the sun comes out. Or I think it was like day 11. The sun comes out. And that's the only reason that this entire state, every wilderness program across the state, did not have a dead kid that winter. That sun came out the day that it did, melted enough so that we could get our shit together and hike out. Again, we had a 12-mile hike that day.
That's the sun was like basically a gift from God. And I mean, it kind of, that when you said that, it kind of reminded me of like day 5 of the USS Indianapolis ordeal. If they hadn't been found on day 5, none of them would have been alive for day 6.
Right.
Nope.
Exactly. If it had snowed more instead of the sun coming out, they would have been lucky.
We wouldn't be having this conversation.
No.
Nope.
I'm glad we are having this conversation. Me too. Now. Even though it's breaking me.
I spent 5 weeks there. I was actually of the group that I was there with, I was the last one to get there and the first to leave. Most of the girls that were in my group, from what I was told, had been there for a couple months already, and stayed longer than I did. So the night they pulled me, actually the day before I was supposed to leave because there was another blizzard forecasted.
Oh God.
And they left all those girls out there. Even after the fact that they couldn't get to us and air rescue was the only way to get to us. They denied that. And then they left the kids out there to do it again. Luckily, it wasn't as bad of a blizzard. So they pulled me out. My parents, again, had a transport company take me from Utah to Montana, put me on a plane, everything. I was wearing Converse low tops and I got to Montana in my program. I think I got there about 8, 9 o'clock at night. It was just me, the girl who transported me and the intake, the woman who did the intake for the program. That's all. I took my shoes off to go inside and do all the intake stuff. Took us about an hour. I go to put my shoes on to go back outside and my feet are swollen. My shoes will not go back on.
Oh.
They ended up swelling before to the end of that night, within probably my first 3 hours there, my feet swelled 8 sizes. And they stayed that way for four months.
Jesus.
4 months. You know how many times they took me to the doctor for it?
None.
Zero?
Zero. Zero. And my first day there, I was targeted by probably the most sadistic staff I've ever come across. And running was her punishment. She loved to make us run miles. And my first day, she was like, okay, we're running 8 miles. Let's get going. When she realized how fucking slow I was, she started running alongside of me, screaming at me, telling me to go faster, and then made the rest of the group keep running until I finished my 8 miles. So they probably did, 20 miles waiting for me. Instantly alienating me from the whole group because that's my fault they had to do that. Yeah. And she did that every chance she got. That was the first time that afterwards, when I got to take my shoes off, I dumped them upside down and blood was dripping out because the skin had cracked and started filling my shoes with blood.
Fuck me.
And when I tried to tell my parents on the phone call, I got through there's something wrong. Instantaneously, they hung up the phone because all phone calls, all communication is fully monitored, supervised, and tailored. If you write something in a letter that they don't like, they'll make you rewrite the letter. They'll tell you what words to use. And so I couldn't even tell my parents. And not only did they hang up the phone, call my parents back and say I was trying to manipulate them to get out of there, but they gave me a 30-day comm ban where I wasn't allowed to call my parents at all.
Hey, you guys keep going. I need a minute, dude. This is killing me. I didn't think this was going to get me like it is. I thought we were going to have I cannot believe you went through all this and you're as strong as you are. That's fucking amazing.
No, I knew that it was going to be rough. But I wasn't expecting this. I've just heard I've just heard podcasters telling, Reader's Digest condensed versions of, the various stories. But we have an actual survivor with us that fucking went through it telling her story and everything, which obviously it's gonna make it 10 times worse, because it's just that's just
she was there. You were there. You know what really happened. You don't know the story that was told about what happened. You know what really fucking happened.
The worst thing about that, I think, for me is until July 18th of this year, the last industry death. That's
my daughter's birthday.
The last industry death before that one was a girl named Taylor Goodridge. She was 17, just like I was.
Fuck.
And she spent 6 weeks with severe nausea, vomiting, stomach pain, and, begging for help. They gave the typical, here's some water, here's some aspirin, you'll be fine. She got a com ban for trying to tell her parents. Yep. She got a com ban for trying to tell her parents, just like I did. And that girl on December 20th, 2022 died in the parking lot of Diamond Ranch Academy alone in the cold because they refused medical care for her. Just like they did to me. And that was 20 years ago for me. There's been no break.
Are you familiar with Gertrude Banaswecki, Nora?
I've heard the name.
I'll be back. You guys keep going. Okay. Don't worry. Just keep going. Right. Don't wait for me. I'll be back.
Okay.
I need a minute. This is like really getting me, which is weird.
It's all right.
I know.
Like I said, the reason we tell our stories,
I know, is so people know.
This is the response that we need. We need to see people say, this is fucking wrong.
It fucking sure as hell is, dude. And I'm totally on your side, dude. Let's fuck these fuckers up, dude. Like, seriously.
Starting with Mitt Romney?
I'm to the point where I'm ready to go guns blazing. Anyway, Mitt Romney. I'll be back. I'm sorry, y'all. Okay. But please keep going. Don't wait for me. Just keep going. Okay. I'll be back.
But Gertrude Banaswecki episode is the torture mom where they brought in a teenage girl under their care and they just basically tortured the shit out of her and she died.
Oh, what was her name Gertrude?
The perpetrator's name was Gertrude.
What was the victim's name?
Sylvia Likens.
Yes, I do know that case.
Okay.
I know victim names much more than I do. I know perpetrator names.
Well, that on that episode that we did, Todd actually tapped out. He's just like, "Fuck you! I'm not talking anymore," because that was like the worst of the worst and everything. And what you have here, and I'm not making fun of Todd and everything. Yeah, Todd. Mm-hmm. It's just I went through hell as a kid. Todd didn't. You went through hell as a kid. Todd didn't.
Yeah. For me, this is just my life.
Yeah, and that's the same way.
Shit that makes it so that I can help all these kids who are coming out of it.
Absolutely.
Who their trauma responses, I mean, as you know, you come out of that shit and your trauma responses rule your life.
But you can, on our episode 10 and 11, which is my cult story, mm-hmm. You can, it's just like at times you can hear Todd just kind of like losing his mind like he was there before. Mm-hmm. And I'm not knocking Todd, you know, and he had no idea. He had no idea I had gone through. This is the first he had ever heard of it. And because I at the time when Todd and I were, you know, were growing up together, like in the 90s and everything, after I had gotten away from it, I didn't talk about it. I didn't start talking about it until I got into my 30s.
I didn't really start talking about it until about 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, when I was already kind of looking into it and everything, and kind of like getting onto like forums and stuff like that and everything, probably around 2008, 2009 or whatever, not really doing anything. But then when I launched the podcast and we did those two episodes, it was just like, okay, I'm in, and I'm kind of, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, me and several other people are like leading the charge against this cult, and it's just like, I mean, this is already going to be, if you don't mind doing a part two,
and as you know, like, we have to tell the details of our truth. We have to tell exactly what happened to us,
but
people like, see.
But the thing is
how horrendous it is.
Todd was, I'm sitting there talking like you are, like, oh, this just, this happened, and Todd's just like, fuck, what the fuck. You know, and it's common for people that, you know, people that went through it just to compartmentalize it and everything. It's just like, I raised in a cult and I also went to Disney World, you know?
Right. Yeah. And it's also incredibly validating and, powerful to see reactions like his, mm-hmm. because that means that we can't minimize it. We can't look at it and say, oh, well, all these other people are still in it and all these other people got all this good out of it. It must not have been that bad. You know, like, I must be exaggerating this.
No, we might have to do.
And then you see those reactions.
We might have to do a second part for this. We're approaching 2 hours now. We could probably go for another
one more quick.
Well, like, we could probably go for another 30-45. We could probably get for like another 30-45 minutes. But
how about I get through just this one other feature of the industry and how it impacted me, and then we can be done. But I want to do it while Todd is gone, because this is a heavy one too. A lot of kids in these programs are over medicated. Right. They had me on 8 different psychiatric medications. 4 of them were antipsychotics. And 2 of them were tranquilizers. My diagnosis was anxiety, depression, and insomnia. They put me on those medications because, you might get this. When I was 8 years old, the Mormon Church, baptizes their children at 8. I was not baptized until I was 8 and a half because I had to prove myself. Because I went into that bishop's office, and when he was asking me questions, I was like, well, I don't really understand. Like, this kid, like an angel showed this kid treasure and he reburied it and then never told anybody about it. Like, are you sure about this? Yeah. I asked questions. And my parents had warned the program that I was going to ask questions. They over-medicated me for 2 reasons. Well, 3 reasons. Compliance. Because if you're a zombie, you can't fight.
Right.
2, I was either going to run or I was going to start a fucking riot. And they weren't wrong. I was too smart to run. I knew there was nowhere to go. I knew that if I ran, I was going to end up in town. Sheriff or somebody else was going to pick me up and I'd end up right back there. Not even going to risk it, because then I would be punished even further.
You and I have rioting, so much in common. It's not even funny. And the reason I say that is, I mean, you haven't listened to 10 and 11 yet, but we go through, it's just, I was the one asking questions, and mm-hmm. I was like routinely beaten every time I asked a question.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, well, this doesn't make sense. Okay. A woman got up and did a testimony and said that, you know, her car wouldn't start. So she laid hands on the car, prayed to God, the car started, and God told her to go straight to the freaking, you know, to a service shop to have the car taken. When they popped the hood, the battery had been stolen. Bullshit.
Yep. Yep.
But when I asked my mom about that, oh, you have, what's the matter? You don't have any faith in everything?
I have always been opinionated, intelligent, and outspoken as fuck. My entire life. My nickname as a kid at school was the girl who knows everything. As I did. See,
a lot of the people that I've come into contact with and everything, you know, since we released those 2 episodes, they weren't the ones that were asking questions or whatever. So I'm kind of in a different bracket to them, and which is like kind of what makes it easier for me to be able to do this. And I imagine it's the same thing with you.
You didn't pick up the brainwashing.
Right.
You were not brainwashed.
Well, actually,
I mean, to an extent you were, but not to the same extent that a lot of the other people were. You kept your faculties. You kept your intelligence. You kept your
curiosity. Even as a kid, I knew. My dad taught me basic maintenance. I knew how to change a tire. I knew how to change oil. I knew how to change out a battery. I even knew how to change out a radiator by the time I was 10 years old. You know, and so when this woman gets up there and she's like, okay, the car ran without a battery. Bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. And that's how I was too. I call people on their shit. Especially when I know for a fact that I am not wrong.
Right.
Yeah. I was targeted with over-medication just for compliance.
I guess one good thing about being in a faith healing cult is we were never targeted with over-medication.
That's true. Have you ever heard of Biderman's Chart of Coercion?
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
It is a tool that was, it's just a very simple 1-page chart. It is a tool that was developed in, I believe, 1956. It might've been 1957 by Albert Biderman. It was, a manual, essentially, for how to torture prisoners of war most effectively. Those tactics, those exact same tactics, are the same ones that they use on kids in these programs.
Okay, so let's talk about, I know that there were instances of sexual abuse. Did that ever happen to you?
Not me personally. I'm not sure that my programs actually had any, legitimate sexual assault. We had two staff members who groomed kids. For instance, there was a girl who really liked to play soccer before our program. She was really good at it, very competitive. And one of the groomers targeted her, latched onto her, and we got to play soccer every fucking weekend. Because he
wanted to fuck her, but never found the way to make it happen.
And when that girl graduated and left the program at 17, it was less than a month before he contacted her outside of the program. God. And what Biderman's chart of coercion is it has the method, the effect and the purpose of that method, and how that method is, ideas of how that method can be used against a prisoner of war. Those methods are isolation, monopolization of perception, humiliation and degradation, exhaustion, threats, occasional indulgences, demonstrating omnipotence, and forcing trivial demands. And I'm sure you've experienced every single one of those too.
Mostly. I was just thinking that, you know, it's just like, maybe I might have experienced that like in a lesser scale, but mm-hmm. but I wouldn't be surprised if people like Rock Terrio really studied that and made it into a science. And Todd's going to have a rough time with it. Actually, you know what? When we cover the Ant Hill Kids, let's just let Todd sit that one out. You want to do that one with me?
I'd be more than happy.
Okay, because Todd won't be able to make it through that one. I mean, he couldn't even make it through this, and I'm not.
And here's an interesting question for you, because we are so similar, and because we did question everything, and then we can end. But did you? Oh, I completely lost my train of thought. Did you come across, and I'm an activist. I work with a lot of survivors. I see a lot of very, very, very broken people. And one thing for me is that when I am triggered, it takes a lot to trigger me to begin with. Second, same. I have done a lot of fucking work on this. I went to my very first therapy appointment as an adult outside of my program that was voluntary and informed for the first time in my life. I've not done therapy for any of this. I've done it on my own.
And I've never done it either. And I even say that in I think episode 11, I think, mm-hmm. but I never did therapy, but I probably should have.
When I am triggered, I can't go to just anybody. I have a very select core group of people who are also incredibly strong, who I can go to, and I can know that that's a safe place to go and that they're going to help me through it. Because if I go anywhere else outside of that core group of people, I'm going to trigger somebody else so much that I'm walking them through it and I'm still left triggered and not helped. Well, I have to help them deal with my trigger.
If you want to add me to that circle, go right ahead.
I could always use that circle to be a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Cause I mean, prior to doing this episode and everything. And yes, people, it is going to be a two-part episode because she's got a lot more to cover and we're closing in on 2 hours right now. It's going to be a two-part. Sorry, Todd.
The next part would be kind of like
what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. Not less gory details and all that
yeah
stuff.
Yeah, but, so Todd's response, that's what I mean when I say my what the thing, my experiences don't trigger me anymore. They're going to trigger every fucking buddy else.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to have to help them through my trigger. Because I don't know. It's just, I have to guide them through that because I have learned to manage shit in a way that, like, I can talk about it like the weather. Like, it's just part of my life.
It's just like some of these like really rough episodes that we cover and everything. Todd's just sitting there freaking out, and I'm just like, and the next day, you know, like it's just because it's just I've been there, done that, and you know, but
I think that's a good stopping point for this one.
Agreed.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's like super triggering. There's nothing that's worse than what I already talked about, so I think we're okay to stop. I just want to get...
This is now a two-part episode, Todd. Okay. But...
I covered all the worst of it.
So you're going to break me again?
No.
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 No. No. We've got a plan, and the next episode is going to be...
As long as you'll have a plan.
How I got the fuck out of there.
Right on.
And we don't need any more gory details. I mean,
I covered all of the heaviest shit while you were gone. I made sure that I was like, I think there were two more topics I wanted to touch on. So we're done with the heavy shit.
All right. I mean, fuck. You know, I mean, it's like, it would be one thing, like I said, like Bill said, if me and him did it, we would have found information and we would have just talked about it.
Yeah,
but actually hearing the stories from somebody that really was there. I mean, when Bill did his story about the cult he was in, that fucking
broke he was me telling too, me you dude. Had to step away from that one too.
It's just no, like,
he didn't I step
just,
away from that one. It was it wasn't Gertrude, that one.
It was
Wecky.
Yeah, it was Gertrude.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that one got me. But I mean, all right. Well, since I'm back, I want to say this: you are my hero now. Nora,
thank you.
You are one of the strongest people I've ever encountered in my life. And
thank you. Yeah.
Damn it, I'm gonna cry. Hold on.
I think I might start a little bit, but like that's funny. Like Bill was saying, you know, we're so desensitized with shit. Like I'm done with tears about this.
It doesn't bother
me. I'm fucking angry, and that anger is getting channeled into action.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm the exact same way. And Todd, you're off the hook with the Ant Hill Kids episode. She's going to do that episode with me. You can take the net off on that one.
Okay.
You're welcome.
More than happy to help.
I mean, there is a part of me that wants to hear all this shit, but at the same time, it's like,
if you couldn't get through Gertrude, you're not going to make it through half of the Ant Hill Kids.
No. All right. Yeah. It's probably best that I take that day off then.
It is by far the worst. By far the worst.
I don't know. Well, I mean, all right. But, dude, her stories, I mean, from actually being there and like, it's like when you did your thing. You know?
I told her about that while you were gone. And it's just like how I'm just sitting here. It's like, okay, well, yeah, I was raised in a cult, and then, you know, and then I went to Disney World. You know, it was just like, it doesn't bother me, but
we were both the ones who called bullshit on all of it though.
Right. Yeah. We were.
That's amazing to me. I've lived a sheltered life. I have not gone through anywhere near the amount of trauma that you all have. And I mean, y'all are amazing. I mean, to me.
Well, and I was also telling him, you know, your reactions like that. I mean, we're so desensitized to it that it almost has lost meaning in a way. But seeing that shit, like, that shows us that
your story's got me. I mean,
you know, we can't minimize this shit. It really was as bad as it was.
I totally believe you. I do.
Your reaction, Todd, needs to be shown.
Yes.
And
I agree.
And it's just like it's not going to affect us like this. I mean, it's just like, oh yeah, I was seeing red and everything, you know, like at some of the shit that she was saying and everything, but it wasn't affecting me the way that it affected you. Yeah. And that's just because we both fucking lived it. You didn't.
Yeah.
And the only way that cults or the troubled teen industry or whatever is going to be, you know, to ever be taken down or whatever is for reactions of people like you,
yeah,
who had no clue about it to just, you know, just like,
oh yeah.
I get it. The troubled teen side, the biggest part of that is that we need people who don't have that stigma of having been broken, unfixable kids, to make it okay for other people to have that same reaction and recognize this for what it is.
Right. Yeah. Well, as much as your stories broke me inside, I'm glad that I heard it. I'm glad that I know about it now. And I'm glad that I did react that way, because now maybe other people will go, holy fuck, dude.
You were
literally talking about legalized kidnapping and pedophilia, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that just boggles my fucking mind at how anybody could do something like that.
Yeah.
And how they're still getting away with it.
Yeah. Yep. And you're a true crime podcaster, and it gets to you.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you said it, you know, Nora said it earlier in the podcast, you know, it goes all the way up to the government. So yeah, there's next to no stopping this. I'm totally for stopping it. And I'm going to learn more as much as I can about it. And I'm going to do what I can.
I just got tipped off to another potential cult. That's a new one that's forming in Texas of all places. And I'm going to start doing some research on that and everything. But
all right.
I'm not going to go into detail.
We hate crimes, killers, cults, and beer cult, right?
Yeah. Led by the Dallas Police Department.
If you haven't listened to that episode yet, Nora, you need to, because
I will.
Me and Bill are no longer allowed in Dallas. I'm pretty sure. Maybe the whole
state. Fuck Dallas. I drove through there once. Fuck that place.
Now you're not allowed to die either.
I still want to go to Vinny's, dude. I mean, that's still on my bucket list. Usually, like, when me and Bill do this, like, with just us, it's like, you know, we're just totally cracking up and picking on the killers because they're dumb fucks. But listening to you talk and telling, like, real stories, I'm like, dude, this is not our regular episode.
No, it's not.
And I'm totally okay with it being your story, because that's the story that needs to be heard. I'm totally fine with it.
It's been a great episode.
Hell yeah.
Thank you.
You know what I mean? And it's like, dude, I didn't even want to make a joke. Even though you said it would be okay if we did. That's what I was worried about at first.
We did a little bit in the beginning. We did a little bit in the beginning, but I was just like,
then when it started getting like really real, it was like, dude, I don't even want to say anything. I'm just taking all this shit in. And I'm like, fuck me, dude.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Part two will be out next week. And, follow us on Twitter, follow us on X.
It's X now. Yes.
Excuse me. That was cool.
Excuse me. Well done.
Facebook and whatnot, and rate and review and everything. And Nora, do you have a name for your podcast yet? And by the time this episode airs.
No, but I got it. I have all my social media set up. I've got an entire website for it. It's called Surviving the Troubled Teen Industry. And that website is www.thetroubledteenindustry.com.
Awesome. And we will definitely link that in the notes, and we'll plug it all on all of our socials as well. And don't forget about our Patreon. Oh yeah. We got a Patreon.
It's actually active now.
It's active. We don't have any subscribers yet, but.
People would rather drink a beer than listen to us.
So. No, Patreon is different than our normal stuff. Yeah. It's different stuff that won't fit on CKCB. So,
yeah.
But, But anyway, you know, part two is coming out next week. And until next week, later.
Cheers, everybody.
See you, fuckers. Go, go, go.